The charter schools debate enters unchartered waters in Miami-Dade. Sexual violence enters terrorist territory in Haiti, and religion enters the holidays more warily than merrily. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll look at an unusual, if not unconstitutional, move by the state to authorize charter schools in Miami-Dade County without the authorization of Miami-Dade Public Schools. We'll also discuss an important new Miami Herald series, Haiti's Lost Generation, on the growing horror of women and girls raped by violent gangs. And we'll try to understand the uneasy place that our faiths and our interfaith efforts are at in this year's holiday season. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bemvindo. The Florida Constitution states that public school boards, quote, shall operate, control, and supervise all free public schools within the school district. By law, charter schools, which are free and publicly funded, even if they're privately operated, are public schools. As a result, by law, one would assume a public school board like Miami-Dade County's would have the authority to oversee charter schools. But under a new system set up by Florida, which critics say violates the state's constitution, the power to authorize new charter schools now belongs to members of the Miami-Dade College Board of Trustees, all of whom were appointed by Republican Governor Ron DeSantis. That new arrangement, according to reporting by WLRN, is set to start in March in Miami-Dade. It's an added layer to Florida's charter schools controversy and, say advocates, another blow to the future of public education. We'd, of course, like to hear your thoughts. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio is WLRN investigative reporter Daniel Rivero, who broke this story this week with our education reporter, Natalie LaRoche-Pietri. How are you, Danny?
I'm doing great.
You and Natalie based this report on a presentation that was given recently to prospective charter schools coming to Florida and Miami, and which you were able to examine. What did this presentation essentially lay out, especially about cutting public school boards like Miami-Dade's out of the charter schools authorization picture? Mm-hmm. And we should point out, this all stems from a new state law that passed in 2022, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, to understand the importance of what's going on right now at Miami-Dade College, you know, we need to understand that if you want to open a charter school in Miami-Dade County, for example, or any county, mm-hmm. you have to go as a charter school owner, operator, to the local school district to approve that charter school. There are guidelines under state law that you need to follow. Someone needs to have an oversight role.
Yeah, and remind us why technically a charter school is regarded as a public school despite the fact that it's privately operated.
Well, they run essentially 100% or close to 100% on public dollars, okay. including when you pay your property tax bill, there's the school part of it, the education part. They get a chunk of that. So it is considered public education, even though it's privately operated. So under the, you know, ever since charter schools opened, the first one here in Miami in 96, mm-hmm. the local school district, the locally elected officials have overseen this process. And what's going on now, and it's really due to this law that passed in 2022, it's just mm-hmm. becoming operational right now.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But what's going on is the state is trying to let Miami-Dade College oversee charter schools and it give the green light for new operators. And the thing is, the board of trustees at Miami-Dade College, none of them are elected. They are 100% appointed by the governor. So there is a very direct line that voters or residents have now to vote on a school board member to make decisions, to have oversight. And they would not have that straight line if this goes forward.
And we're talking about authorization over this situation across the state, not just Miami-Dade County, right?
Well, in this case, Miami-Dade, to our knowledge, is the first and the only college.
And that's going to start in March, as you pointed out.
Right. So that would be for Miami-Dade County alone, because each college in the state has kind of a zone, and Miami-Dade College's zone is for Miami-Dade County.
So under this system, then, if we're talking about Brevard County or, right. Or Hillsborough, for example, another entity would be the authorizing agent for charter schools in that county and not the public schools district?
Well, so according to people that have been following this for a long time that we've talked to, the fear for some people that want to protect traditional public schools and protect the right for elected officials to have oversight over this is that traditionally, and this is fact, Miami and Miami-Dade County have been kind of the petri dish for charter school experiments in the state of Florida. The first charter was opened here, like I said, in 96. A lot of the earlier companies that became, you know, huge multi-million dollar companies, they're started down here, they're founded down here, and then it's expanded to the rest of the state. So the fear is that they're going to start this in Miami-Dade County, and you know, if no one challenges it or it goes forward or it beats whatever challenge it has, in the next couple of years, we're going to have Sarasota College doing the same in Sarasota County and blah, 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 all across the state.
But so much authority is being conferred on the Miami-Dade College Board of Trustees in this instance, because I get the feeling a lot of it has to do with an entity called the Florida Charter Institute.
Right. The Florida Charter Institute was created a couple of years ago by state statute, sponsored by Manny Diaz Jr., who later became the Commissioner of Education for Florida.
Right.
And that, it's kind of this think tank study research institute.
At Miami-Dade College.
At Miami-Dade College, headquartered at Miami-Dade College. They have recruited kind of a who's who of charter school experts around the country. So it is actually a really important organization nationally for the charter school movement.
Right.
And in addition to the research kind of role for that, now they're being authorized to directly have oversight over charter schools and do the work.
Now, as you point out in your report, this sort of bypassing of public school board authority in the charter school authorization process was attempted before, about 20 years ago, right? But it was ruled unconstitutional?
That is right. In 2006, there was a law that was passed under former Governor Jeb Bush.
Right.
Marco Rubio was Speaker of the House. And that made an attempt to have a statewide authorizer. So the state wanted to take this for themselves and say, hey, we as a state are going to authorize new charter schools across the state. We're not going to go through the locally elected school districts. They lost in court. And then it went to an appeals court and they lost. And I read the opinion and the appeals court judge said this is blatantly unconstitutional. Like, it literally says this responsibility is with a school board. There's no ambiguity about it. So it's already been tried and failed here in Florida before.
So we see Florida and Florida Republicans trying this again now, which brings up two questions, really. Why do Governor DeSantis and company think it will pass constitutional muster this time? I mean, we probably can expect litigation, no?
If someone brings it, considering that a similar thing lost in the past, there is a chance that it could get struck down if it is, you know, taken to court. But at the same time, the court case in 2008 was never appealed to the state Supreme Court. So there's never been this statewide ruling on this topic.
Right. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with WLRN's Daniel Rivero about his and Natalie LaRoche-Pietri's exclusive report this week about public school boards effectively being cut out of the charter school authorization process in Florida, starting with Miami-Dade counties. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So the other question this brings, you know, up at least for me, Danny, is then why is the Florida GOP, or why have they been and still are, so intent, if not obsessed, with cutting public school boards out of the charter school authorization picture?
The broader picture is Florida sees itself as a leader in the school choice movement. And there's not a lot of love, I think we can say pretty blanketly, on the Republican or conservative side in the state of Florida for public education.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a fact. They've taken swings at it in every session that I can remember. And this is kind of an additional part on that. And they don't see any, you know, real downside to that. Now, there was a meeting with the education commissioner just a few weeks ago before school district members and board members from all across the state. And he made some comments to them that I was actually pretty shocked that even people in very conservative districts were saying, hold on, like you guys are going way too far here. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it is interesting. It will be interesting how it all plays out.
I know that, you know, in your report also, there's this sense that it charter schools see Florida as a refuge, a sanctuary.
That's right.
As compared to states like New York, where they feel more embattled, right?
Right. So one of the big things happening kind of in the backdrop here is...
And we should point out, we've got a large number of kids in Florida charter schools, about almost 400,000,
It's about 400,000... If it was its own district, it'd be the largest in the state.
Right. And we're talking about almost 800 charter schools in the state.
Yeah. Right, right. Mm-hmm. So one of the things happening now is, Success Academy, this very successful, highly regarded charter school network out of New York, is moving down to Florida. Just Governor DeSantis hosted them at a press conference and unveiling a couple months ago. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of excitement for that. In New York, there's a cap on how many charter schools can exist and be created, and New York has hit that cap actually.
Yeah.
Florida has no cap. So we're starting to see big name charter operators from across the country trying to bring their operations down to Florida. Mm-hmm. And now, as an added part of it, they don't have to deal with elected officials.
Yeah.
They can go through governor appointees, which is a whole different ballgame.
So, Danny, finally, in the minute we have left, are Florida's public school boards pushing back on this? I mean, your report, for example, quotes Miami-Dade school board member Luisa Santos, who is not happy with this arrangement. What's the key complaint on their side to this?
You know, the key complaint is they're being cut out. I mean, this is authority they have when you look at the law, at the state constitution. This is just them losing the authority. I mean, and the school district here in Miami-Dade approved 100% of the charter schools in the last several years, but they have the authority to deny one if they want to.
And we should point out a lot of these charter schools under another arrangement that we're seeing under dispute here is that a lot of these charter schools could be operating in the public school spaces.
Right, right. There's overlapping concerns for the school district. And, they might not have as much say in the coming months as they have in the past.
Daniel Rivero is WLRN's investigative reporter. Danny, thanks as always.
Thanks, Tim.
Still to come, a new Miami Herald series examines the ghastly reality of gang sexual violence in Haiti. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. The gang violence in Haiti seems to have no bottom. This year, the country's powerful gang staged a vicious offensive out of Port-au-Prince and into Haiti's interior, massacring and burning towns along the way to gain strategic corridors. But amid that brutality is one especially evil form of gang terror in Haiti that has only recently come to full light. Human rights groups say 4,000 women and girls were victims of gang sexual violence last year, and this year the number of cases likely doubled. Rape cases involving minors increased 1,000% last year, and this year looks no better. That horror is the subject of a new series by Miami Herald reporter Jacqueline Charles titled Haiti's Lost Generation, about the toll on women and girls raped by the gangs. Her unsettling but important project brings us closer to those thousands of Haitian sexual violence victims, and just as important, it drives home more deeply how urgent it is for the U.S. and the international community to end gang rule in Haiti. Do you know someone in Haiti who has suffered from gang violence? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576, and we should warn our listeners that some of what we're about to discuss is disturbing. Joining me now in the studio is the Miami Herald's Caribbean reporter, Jacqueline Charles. Jackie, thanks for coming in, and congratulations on this very necessary series, which I know could not have been easy to either report or write.
Thank you. You're right. I needed like several weeks after the reporting just to digest what I'd heard and just get through my own mental trauma, because the women and the girls that I met, that I spoke to, they were just so broken. When you thought you heard one bad story, the next story was worse, if you can imagine.
And when I say not easy to report, I don't just mean emotionally, but also security-wise. You and Miami Herald photographer Jose Iglesias took no small risk in going to Haiti to produce this series, not just given the ubiquitous gang violence there, but also the chronic risk of being kidnapped by those same gangs. How hazardous was the work?
You know, it was interesting because when we first started on this project and we wanted to go, we had plans, we were ready to get on the flight, and then we couldn't go because the gangs had taken over a road leading into the Artibonite. Mm-hmm. So that was just too
risky. The Artibonite being the interior province
of Haiti, right? Exactly, just north of Port-au-Prince. Mm-hmm. And because this was a place where, you know, I'm talking to UNICEF and they said, no, we need to get down there. We need to talk about this.
Yeah.
And so we couldn't go. So we were basically waiting it out for a couple of months. And then finally we went to the south. We went to some of the areas where people were fleeing, and then we went into Port-au-Prince. And so in Port-au-Prince, you know, in the main story, one of the NGOs that we talked to has one of the few rape shelters in the country with beds, OFAVA, and they had to leave their location to go to another location. So for us, you know, we're driving around. I mean, some of the victims, survivors, because they are survivors, even though they're victims
right.
of the violence.
Good point.
Basically, some were provided to us with some of the groups that have been working with them, but I also wanted to find people on my own. Some of them were homeless on the streets.
Yeah.
So you know how Haiti is. It's very volatile. One day you're there, things are fine, and literally the next day, things blow up. So
yeah.
That's what you're dealing with, that kind of stress in trying to report a project like this.
No doubt. But as hazardous as the work may have been, it's extraordinarily important work. As other journalists like myself who cover Haiti know, the sexual violence plague that the gangs have brought to Haiti is horrendous. How horrendous would you characterize the emergency, Jackie, both in the present and what it promises to do to Haiti in the long term?
You know, the title of this series is Haiti's Lost Generation.
Right.
And we're not just talking about the women and girls, which I'll return to in a minute, but we're also talking about young boys. I mean, 30 to 50% of the membership of these armed gangs are young mm-hmm. people, 8-year-olds.
Oh, yeah. The UN says half of the membership is minors now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the recruitment has gone up by 70%. And so when you think of that, the minors who are in the gangs, and you think about the minors who are being raped by the gangs, mm-hmm. and the assailants are getting younger and younger, you're looking at an entire generation that's going to be lost to this violence. And, you know, when I'm talking to a 14-year-old girl who's telling me she just came home from school, her dad is being held at gunpoint, she and her father are forced to watch her
right.
stepmother be raped, and then he is gunned down in front of her, and it just doesn't end there.
I actually want to go right now to that, how you start the Lost Generation series with that heartbreaking story of Micheline, a 14-year-old who last year was repeatedly and torturously raped for days in a field after gang members killed her father, as you just pointed out, and torched their family's home. Why is Micheline's case so typical of what is happening to women and girls in Haiti right now? And what is the one atypical thing about her tragedy that you also point out?
So let me talk about the atypical. You know, when I was talking to her, I, at one point, through my own tears, I said, how are you still standing? How are you not, like, falling apart? And she started talking to me about the counseling that she received through this group, OFAVA, which was possibly because of Doctors Without Borders. They're borrowing counselors. That's how they were able to do it, patchwork.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in a country where often things don't work, the day that she escaped, there was a God looking out for her. And if you don't believe in God, I'm sorry, but think about this. This girl, for 5 days, she's sequestered, tied to a chair with 5 other young women, repeatedly raped, no food, no water. Her assailants are hooded. And that morning, there's a rumor that there was going to be a police operation, and they raped them before they leave. And then the one person who's left, for whatever reason, he decides to free them. She takes off. She passes out in a field. A Samaritan, good Samaritan, a man, finds her face down, looks at her, realizes she's a child. He doesn't take advantage of her. He takes her to the police brigade for minors.
For minors,
which
right.
normally is not working. But
yeah.
That day, he found them. They were working. They were patient with her. After a week, she was able to say what happened to her. And then they got her in one of the few, and when I say few, I'm talking about maybe 2 or 3 rape shelters that actually have beds.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually had a bed that was available, because they told me that so many times they have to turn people away because they have nowhere to keep them.
Doctors Without Borders told me earlier this year that they didn't think they'd ever be able to accommodate all of the victims or survivors, as you mentioned, that are coming to them.
Exactly. So she was able to, they took her in, and because she's been able to stay there, go to school, do therapy, I mean, she's an example of how you don't have to be broken. I mean, there's a quote in her where she says, you know, I lost the most important person in my life, my father, and I thought that my life was over, and they told me that, no, I can have hope and my life isn't over.
Yeah. But what was the other atypical thing about her? I mean, you've just laid out what's sort of very, unfortunately, very typical about cases like this in Haiti. But there was one atypical thing also that you point out.
Well, despite all of this, that you know, you would consider her to be fortunate because she didn't end up pregnant. She didn't end up with an STD because so many survivors, they do. They end up with, you know, HIV or some transmitted disease because they can't get there within 72 hours. And we have young girls. You saw in the series, there are number of survivors who I spoke to who were impregnated by their assailants.
What affected you most, Jackie, and should affect the rest of us most, about the other cases you reported for this series, such as a 38-year-old woman named Janique who was attacked in Arcaye, Haiti, or Judith, a 25-year-old woman who now lives on the street in Port-au-Prince with a developmentally challenged toddler son, who was the result of gang rape? What do you want us to take most away from these narratives?
You know, the Judith story, I needed to break that story out because I didn't want it to get lost. And I wanted to show that by the time that these women are victimized by the gangs, they have been victimized by so many things in society. You know, because they're poor, that's been criminalized. They've been dehumanized. She was a repeated victim of the gang violence. And, you know, and she had just returned to Cité Soleil, and she's in a house with six other people.
Cité Soleil being one of the slums in
Port-au-Prince. Mm-hmm. And she's in there with her 7-year-old niece, who was also raped and died soon after this rape. And both she and her sister were both impregnated. And let me just say this. She calls her mother out from the countryside to come and be with her, and her mother is killed while she's on a public bus because of a gang clash. And then 22 days after she has her child, she has a stroke. I mean, this is one incident happens, and it just creates this whole domino effect. Yeah. So there's so many Judith. And then with Yannick, I'll just say quickly, this is a woman who twice a week she goes to Arcaye to buy plantains and vegetables to make a living. And one day the buses stop and they're taken into a field and they're sexually violated. That if you are a woman or girl in Haiti, and in some cases even a boy or man, every day you're living by chance.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with the Miami Herald's Jacqueline Charles about her new series, Haiti's Lost Generation, about the sexual violence terror Haiti's powerful gangs have visited on the country's women and girls. You can call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Jackie, another especially painful and poignant facet of your series is its exploration of what happens to the babies and children of women and girls who become pregnant after gang rape in Haiti. But it's also an exploration of the double jeopardy sexual violence survivors face there, because there is next to no access to legal abortion, right?
So as of this month, Haiti's new law goes into effect. And if you can imagine that they were still operating with a law from like the 1800s. Mm-hmm. And so this new criminal code now allows abortion as a result of rape. Thank God.
Do you think that stems from the gang sexual violence terror the country's been seeing in the past few years?
Yes, there was huge advocacy to push this. I mean, and we know with, you know, Haitians being Catholic and all of this, but you have to think about this. You know, I started the reason why I started on this series, because I had a curious question. What happens to an 11-year-old girl who is raped, gets pregnant, is forced to carry the baby to term, and then this baby is born and she has no connection to this child? It was a conversation I had with Dr. Pop, Bill Pop, who's a leading public health doctor. And this is what he was starting to see. So this was the story I wanted to tell. But as I went in search of that 11-year-old girl, I found the Judiths, I found the Micheline, I found the Yanniques, and realized that this is so much more complicated and so much deeper than this. But the country's laws are still too antiquated. I mean, there's an anecdote in one of the stories that could probably get lost, but it's talking talking about the strain that health organizations are under. And there's a young lady who was in the Jacmel in the southeast part of Haiti. She was raped in Port-au-Prince. The gangs killed her mother, her father, her brothers, and then she was impregnated. She fled to Jacmel. She's on the radio. She's asking for help. A couple decides that they're going to take her in. They don't know her. Everybody, including the welfare office, acknowledges that this woman is suicidal and will probably kill this child if left alone. Mm-hmm. The couple ask if they can take in the baby because Haiti law doesn't allow you to adopt a child under the age of 3. Mom flees the house one day. Mm-hmm. And instead of saying to this couple, yes, I'm going to allow you to take and care for this child, they were trying to force the mother to accept this child. I said to the child welfare person, the director who told me the story, I said, at what point do we try to save the child and not the mother?
Yeah. Good. Haiti's Lost Generation also looks at the struggles of aid groups, as you've just mentioned, trying to help these sexual violence survivors, such as Doctors Without Borders. One of the points they make is that this is a scourge that's become so difficult to confront in Haiti because the gangs have all but adopted rape as a weapon of war, right? That seems like a facet of this that you really wanted us to try to appreciate in your series.
Yes, because gang members will tell you that they don't rape people in their quote-unquote territory. It's during these rival clashes or these fight for territory when they go into another gang's fiefdom that they carry out these rapes. I mean, that is such a poor excuse. And the violence,
the least, yeah.
You know, and when we talk about gang rape, we're talking about multiple people raping one person at once as well. It's not just because you're a member of a gang, but also the act itself. And so, yes, it's very difficult because often the survivors can't leave the neighborhoods to go get help, or organizations like Doctors Without Borders can't get in, or if mm-hmm. they're in, they have to use these sort of camouflage activities to try to assist women, where they do these safe spaces, make it seem like it's community groups or it's a crocheting, but really what they're doing is trying to see if they can help these survivors, because there's a lot of them also sex slaves. They're trapped. You know, that we didn't get a lot into that, but a lot of these women in these neighborhoods, not only have they been sexually violated, but they're repeatedly so, and they're trapped in these communities.
Now, as a result of that reality, are Haitian authorities, who are overwhelmed by the heavily armed gangs as it is, are they really able at all to prevent the sexual violence nightmare? You mentioned in your reporting, for example, that the victim, Micheline, when she finally escaped, she presented herself at the Haitian Police Brigade for the Protection of Minors. But is there really any protection anymore for minors in Haiti?
There really is not. And, you know, one of the disturbing things, you know, question when we were finalizing it, one of the editors says, why the lack of outrage? And it's one of these questions that I'm sure you ask yourself this sometimes. As long as you've been covering Haiti, you have to ask somebody else, why the lack of outrage? You have to kind of check yourself, right? And one of the things that I have been very disturbed by in the reporting of this and the continued reporting is, let's look at the stats. 1 in 4 persons in Port-au-Prince now live in a neighborhood controlled by gang. And yet these individuals, these survivors of gang violence, whether it's sexual violence, you know, hit kidnappings, they are being viewed as complicit. They're not seen as victims. And so there's this lack of empathy. You hear the UN talking about the gang violence. You hear other countries saying we need to do something, telling the US government, we need to look at gender-based violence. This needs to be part of the conversations with this new force. But what we don't
new
hear...
New force being the gang suppression force that they've just created.
Exactly. Yeah. But what we don't hear in Haitian society is that we need to stop. This has gone too far. And that's what I'm hoping that we wrote this, we translated this in French. We're hoping to also get a Creole version up. But I want Haitians to first, let's start talking about it and let's deal with the reality. We're not going to solve it overnight, but there needs to be outrage.
Right. Let's hope. Jacqueline Charles is the Miami Herald's Haiti and Caribbean reporter. Jackie, many thanks.
Thank you.
Still to come. Do our community's religious faiths feel mired in melees this holiday season? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. Usually at this holiday time of year, when, for example, we see that overlap between Hanukkah and Christmas, we like to talk about not just how healthy our community's faith spirit is, but how reassuring its interfaith spirit is. But that just doesn't seem all that appropriate this year for some reason. In the Christian community, you can feel a schism of sorts over the immigration issue. You can feel a rift in the Jewish community over Gaza. Ditto in the Muslim community over the Palestine-Hamas dilemma. And that intra-faith malaise can feel as though it's carrying over into the inter-faith wariness as well. Christians feel persecuted. Look at what's happening in Nigeria. Jews are feeling an alarming rise in anti-Semitism. Look at the violence that just happened in Australia. And Muslims here in Florida are having to sue Governor Ron DeSantis for designating one of their major advocacy groups, CARE, as a terrorist organization. Does faith feel more fretful than usual this holiday season? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. But just a warning, we will not take calls that disparage a particular religious faith. Joining me now in the studio is an especially thoughtful journalist on this subject, Miami Herald religion reporter Lauren Costantino. Lauren, thanks for coming in. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Our listeners might remember you and I having a fairly optimistic, upbeat holiday conversation at this time last year about the interfaith vibe here in South Florida. We talked about a large interfaith dinner you had just written about. We certainly don't want to say the interfaith vibe isn't there this year, but we also can't deny that the world has sort of intervened in ways that make the interfaith spirit feel a bit strained this holiday season. Is that a fair assessment of 2025 compared to 2024?
I think so. You know, there's still a lot of great interfaith efforts that are being made, but I think each sort of individual group is kind of going through it this year in their own ways.
Mm-hmm. And that also then translates into perhaps less interfaith outreach.
Sure, is sort I of think what we're people getting at. Yeah. are sort of turning inward and, you know, not really sort of making those steps to bridge the divides.
And I want to get into that soon here. But Lauren, what are some of the factors that might be working against interfaith connection this year? As I mentioned at the outset, each of the three major faiths most represented here in South Florida all seem to have a cloud, let's say, to point to. Christians feel persecuted, especially in places like Nigeria, as I mentioned. Jews are facing a startling rise in the kind of anti-Semitic violence we just saw in Australia. And Muslims in Florida are dealing with their own governor all but labeling them as terrorists. How do things like this perhaps compel people, as you just said, to turn inside their own faiths and do less outside engagement?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of things happening. I think people are not seeing this sort of message of unity coming from their leaders at the top. You know, we're not getting that message like sort of post 9/11 that we're all Americans. We need to, find the similarities in one another. People are feeling really divided right now. And I think sometimes in their own religious beliefs in their own houses of worship, in some cases, people are actually being told that there are enemies on the other side. You know, I saw, for example, a reel on Instagram coming from a Christian pastor that was all about, you know, labeling Muslims as the enemy and saying, you know, we need to sort of get rid of these Muslims who are in positions of power. And I couldn't believe that this was coming from a Christian pastor, kind of, you know, really sparking this divide and sort of painting the other as the enemy.
And real quick, let's remind people why Governor DeSantis has labeled the Council of American Arab
Islamic Relations,
Islamic Relations, known as by the acronym CARE, why he is designating CARE here in Florida as a terrorist organization.
Yeah, so the governor is drawing sort of a straight line between CARE and more extreme conservative Islamic groups like the Muslim Brotherhood. And
right.
He's kind of connecting them to groups like Hamas. He's mentioning a case called the Holy Land Foundation, which was a a terrorism financing case that was post 9/11, you know, that had to do with a Muslim charity that's now defunct. And, you know, CARE is arguing that they are not involved in these activities, that they, you know, are simply because they're being targeted because of their pro-Palestinian views and politics that, mm-hmm. you know, are in opposition to the governor's pro-Israel stance. But yes, yeah, so he's basically making it very difficult for CARE to exist in Florida as a
nonprofit. Because it has practical implications right. in terms of contracts and things of that nature that they as a nonprofit could have access to.
Right, yeah. And it's also sparked this lawsuit from CARE that's saying this right. is unconstitutional. So mm-hmm. it's sort of this battle between right. CARE and the governor. But I think, you know, on its face, what most people sort of look at that and they see terrorism, they see Muslim organization, they don't really look mm-hmm. that much into it because there's an argument right. about the Holy Land Foundation case, and they sort of associate, you know, Muslims with terrorists automatically. And I think yeah. that's, you know, a detrimental
impact.
We
should point out the same thing's going on in Texas. Governor Abbott yes. there also designated CARE a terrorist organization mm-hmm. in his state. Let's listen to one of South Florida's faith leaders, Rabbi Greg Weissman of Temple Beth El in Boca Raton, talking to WLRN here about what it's like for Jews this week, trying to celebrate the joy of Hanukkah, which began on Sunday, the same day as the Bondi Beach massacre in Australia of 15 Jews at a Hanukkah event.
You had Jews coming together with the simple message of celebrating a holiday that has over two millennia of history for us. And Jews being targeted just for celebrating that holiday. And so that brings a certain pain and devastation and anger to us emotionally, but it also has practical applications. Lighting a menorah in the back corner of our home or in our basement isn't enough. So we're supposed to go out in public and share this message at a time when a lot of Jews feel frightened to be out in public.
Lauren, again, how does this sort of tragedy perhaps make it harder for people of that particular faith to reach out to people of other faiths? Or in this case, should I point out the fact that it was a heroic Muslim who prevented many more deaths there in Australia by disarming those two men who were shooting at Jewish people on Bondi Beach? Should that perhaps argue for interfaith outreach?
Yeah, I think it could go either way. You know, I think Jews right now are feeling like the need for their leaders to step up and to, you know, denounce anti-Semitism and to take action to make them feel safer in their communities. And they're saying, you know, we need to focus on our safety. And I think Muslims are focusing on maybe separating themselves from those more extremist groups. And mm-hmm. And, you know, I think maybe that makes it harder for them to, you know, when you're dealing in extremes, it's hard to kind of look for the nuance and the common ground. And, you know, but I think something like a potluck or just sitting with a friend who is a different faith than you, like, that's what needs to happen. But I think these groups are really focused on their own safety and then, you know, also making sure that they're not being persecuted on yeah. institutional levels.
But speaking of that term you just brought up, common ground,
yeah.
One of the issues that seems to be prompting more interfaith energy and common ground this year is immigration. Here's a South Florida Muslim leader, Dr. Abdul Hamir Samra, who is the imam and religious director of the Islamic Center of Greater Miami in Miami Gardens. And he's speaking here to how immigration actually serves as a common bond between faiths.
I think all the faiths, they all stand for human rights, for human values, for human dignity. And this shouldn't be negotiable, that the dignity of a human being, because that dignity was given by God to all human beings. That's what our holy book, the Quran, said. God honored the children of Adam and made them all equal and gave them the dignity. So we need to protect this dignity of our human fellows.
Lauren, what about Dr. Samra's point there about immigration as an interfaith engine?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's right. I covered a couple of the interfaith vigils happening out in Alligator Alcatraz
right.
in the
mm-hmm.
Everglades.
Mm-hmm.
And it truly is an interfaith effort. And I think, you know, what those faith leaders are saying is that for us, this is a human rights issue. And our faith is sort of driving our social activism in this way. I think a lot of, you know, different denominations in their doctrine, they have something along the lines of welcoming the stranger or, you know, helping somebody in need who's vulnerable.
But it was also interesting that he talked about the children of Adam, because we often forget that Christianity, Islam, and Judaism have that common Abrahamic foundation or origin.
Right. So, yeah, I think it's, you know, it's interesting, like maybe in the Catholic Church, immigration might be an issue that is causing a bit of a divide, depending on where you fall and how conservative you are of a Catholic. But in general, I think, you know, we're seeing there was even an interfaith, if you want to call it that, lawsuit where a bunch of different denominations came together to sue the federal government over, you know, when they decided that churches were not no longer going to be a safe space. And that ICE could go.
That's
and
a good point.
Arrest. So that was an interfaith effort as well.
That was an interfaith moment. No, that's a good point. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with Miami Herald religion reporter Lauren Costantino about the unusual faith and interfaith uneasiness we seem to be feeling at the holiday season this year. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Lauren, we were just talking about immigration serving as an issue that facilitates interfaith engagement in a community like South Florida, but I think we also need to point out that immigration can serve as an intra-faith divider. And I'm speaking, of course, about Christianity in this instance, where we've seen very different views on immigration between denominations like evangelicals and Catholics. Roman Catholic Father Federico Capdepon of Corpus Christi Catholic Church in Miami and the Haitian nonprofit Kepoze laid out that reality for us.
The division is a reality. Under my perspective, I'm a little frustrated. It's a pity to see a lack of compassion and lack of empathy with our brothers and sisters that are suffering, that they are already here. I do not understand why people, besides politics, is not to be able to understand the suffering of a mother being removed or being deported, the children left behind. Most of the people are Catholics.
Now, as I pointed out, we've seen this dynamic where perhaps evangelicals who tend to be a little more politically aligned with MAGA and President Trump tend to have been more supportive of his immigration crackdown, the president's immigration crackdown and his deportation campaign. We've seen, however, the Roman Catholic side of things being very much in opposition to President Trump's immigration crackdown. So how do you feel, Lauren, issues like immigration are affecting the ecumenical spirit, let's say, among Christians?
Sure. And I just also want to push back on that a little bit. I think there are Latino evangelical
groups. Sure, that's a very good point. In fact, they came out really hard against it.
I've spoken to a couple pastors who have, you know, they're on the, you know, forefront of this movement. And, you know, it's really because it's an issue that's affecting their congregation. Like if you have a, you know, Spanish speaking congregation with a lot of, you know, immigrants like here in South Florida, I think it's something you can't ignore. You have to sort of stand up. And as you know, as I've seen a lot of priests, you know, also Catholic priests showing up to some of these vigils and, you know, they're basically saying it's an issue that they can't ignore. Maybe in another part of the country where, you know, people are not understanding sort of the nuances of immigration or that's not as common in their community, maybe it's not an issue that their parish or their church feels that they need to speak out against. But
I'm glad you brought that up.
Schisms.
I'm glad you brought that up because the largest Latino evangelical pastor organization here in Florida, I remember a year or so ago, did come out against the immigration crackdown. So I'm
But I know what you meant about sort of that far right Christian nationalism sort of groups that are, you know, standing with the president.
But as a Catholic myself, though, I'd say issues like immigration aren't just dividing different denominations from each other. They're also dividing folks within their denominations. I see it in my Catholic parish here in Miami. Are intra-faith schisms like this also making the holidays this year a bit more of a downer in the religion department? Because, as I said, you can go to some Catholic parishes and you can see some parishioners who don't like the fact that a priest may be preaching against the Trump immigration crackdown from the pulpit, and that creates, again, intra-faith
schisms. I think it has to do with how politically active you want your faith leader to be, right? There are some churches like Coral Gables Congregational UCC where the pastor is, Lori Hafner. She is sort of well known to be somebody who shows up to protests, partners with Books and Books. She's very politically active and for what she believes is right. And I think some people, they feel like I keep politics out of my religion, and maybe that creates a disagreement within a congregation. But I think Christians are kind of going through that right now, right? Like, your expression of Christianity is not the same as mine, and we disagree on these issues. So, are we able to come together and celebrate holidays together? Hopefully, people can disagree and still show up to the same house of worship.
Well, yeah, and speaking of intra-faith problems, we can't ignore, this is not just a Christian problem, we can't ignore the sometimes bitter divide we're seeing inside Judaism these days over Gaza, and I think a similar divide among Muslims when it comes to Gaza and Hamas, no?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. You have, Jews who disagree on Zionism and where they stand. You have Jewish Voices for Peace that is, very pro-Palestinian. And you've had, some Jews even being labeled like self-hating Jews if they're not Zionist. It gets very sort of kind of ugly when it comes to that. And I think Muslims have that same thing as well. I think some people in the Muslim community believe, if you're a nonprofit, group, you should be doing advocacy for Muslims and maybe not Palestine. And then some like CARE saying, we're going to do all of it. We have to stand up for people in Gaza. So it really, it's kind of this merging of politics and religion that I think is causing that
divide. Speaking of that merging, would I be right in also saying that one of the things that also perhaps has dampened the interfaith spirit in communities like South Florida is people who are not Jews, looking in from the outside, they feel like they don't want to touch fire in the sense that they're very dismayed by the realization that a lot of Jews will take opposition to Benjamin Netanyahu's government as anti-Semitism. They don't understand the conflation of those two things, and it would seem to me that that's something else that maybe doesn't exactly promote interfaith spirit.
Yes, definitely. I agree with you on that. I was just at a press conference yesterday where over a dozen mayors came together to denounce anti-Semitism. And, they said pretty clearly, we're not here to debate this issue or to get into politics. We're just here to say that Jews need to feel safe in the community. But there's definitely been some, I think, conflating, as you said, between the pro-Palestinian cause and It just gets very complicated. I don't know if I want to get into that.
No,
right,
I understand. Just, in the 10 seconds we have left, do you still, though, feel optimism about interfaith outreach in South Florida?
I do, because I show up to a lot of these interfaith sort of dinners and events. And there's a sort of Jewish Muslim dialogue series that's going on right now with Temple Beth Am and FIU that I'll shout out, that's doing some great work asking the tough questions. So.
Lauren Costantino is the Miami Herald's religion reporter. Lauren, many thanks.
Thanks so much.
Finally on the roundup, here at WLRN, we were devastated this week by the death of a talented and dear colleague, WLRN's director of TV production, Michael Anderson. Michael was an award-winning filmmaker and longtime documentary producer, and he was especially passionate about South Florida's Black history. One of his most notable works was last year's WLRN documentary, Never Drop the Ball, which explored the influential yet often overlooked history of the Negro baseball leagues. Michael joined us on the South Florida Roundup to talk about the film.
The Negro Leagues was a great sport. It was a great game, and it was very inclusive as well. So it brought women into baseball. It included other nationalities into baseball. There were Black and white owners in the Negro Leagues.
Right.
You know, and back to the Miami Giants. So the Miami Giants weren't officially a part of the Negro Leagues, but they were a barnstorming team, bringing a game to people that have never even seen professional baseball in that way. Yeah.
Michael's other important projects included Hero of a Thousand Faces, celebrating the stories of Black men inspiring future generations and reshaping communities. Michael Anderson made a rich impact on this community, and we will miss him greatly. Michael Anderson died Sunday from a heart attack at his Miami home. He was 58. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news, the vice president of radio, and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.